The way primary care services are delivered has changed over recent years and continues to change to adapt to increased demand amid continuing challenges with workforce. In this podcast, we hear from system leaders in Cheshire and Merseyside about how they are responding to the challenges with a strategic framework offering a roadmap for the next few years. Our host is Chief Executive of Health Innovation North West Coast, Dr. Phil Jennings.
So hello and welcome to another edition of the Health Innovation North West Coast podcast. I'm Phil Jennings, I'm the Chief Exec here at Health Innovation North West Coast. Today I'm joined by two colleagues in primary care, Jonathan and Adam, who I'm going to get to introduce themselves in just a moment. And we're going to be talking about the strategic framework for primary care. So let me go first to Adam. Adam, say hello and tell us who you are and what you do.
Hello. So my name's Adam Irvin. I'm a community pharmacist and I'm here today because I'm a primary care board member at NHS Cheshire and Merseyside.
Thanks very much. And Jonathan, welcome back to the podcast. Once again, introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you, Phil. It's good to be back. My name is Jonathan Griffiths. I am a GP and I'm also Associate Medical Director for Primary Care for NHS Cheshire and Merseyside.
Okay, so I thought a good way to start would be to get your particular take on primary care from your individual perspective. So I think maybe Adam will start with you first. You're a pharmacist by background. How's it feeling in pharmacy land at the minute? What are the big issues for you? How do you and colleagues find the current climate?
So pharmacy's had a bit of a rough few years, to be fair. We've had significant pressures in funding, in workforce and the capacity. Part of it in some of the context of government arrangements, part of it in what the actual demand on the system is. Because obviously we've come through COVID, we've had significant pressures through COVID. Pharmacy has had quite a lot of pressure in that point where they're being front and centre and a lot of services have been directed there. And then that's in a background of flat funding through government. We've had significant demand on our services as general practices equally had high demand. The number of prescriptions written has gone up and seems ever increasing, but the funding for the work to do that has stayed flat. So that's had some market effects, and it's been really interesting to see how we've gone through that. So we've seen some mega market shifts. We've seen Lloyds Pharmacy starting the year as the second largest pharmacy chain. That's en route to have disappeared from the market altogether by the end of the year. I think at the peak there operated 1,700 pharmacies. It's fewer than 50 today. We've also had Boots closing about a sixth of their estate this year and many other contractors suffering similarly. It's not all doom and gloom, and I think that's probably just a context in which we're operating in. And I think the things we see in the press are things like the significant issues obtaining medicines due to whole ranges of factors. So global market, raw material issues, Brexit effects, all of those add up. But the message I want to put across is pharmacy's working really, really hard to minimise any disruption from that. And actually, there's been some... The timing of this is some really good timing because we've had some Pharmacy First services announced this morning. So this is part of a delivery plan for recovering access to primary care for many people who can't access them. And it's about using pharmacies as that first port of call for healthcare advice. And I'll come on to a few bits of that later on if I can. I think it'd be more relevant to that point. But the context is it's pressurised. Funding, workforce capacity is probably the big issues, along with some stock availability elements of it. But pharmacy's really keen to be a solution to try and help our population get through those issues.
That's great. And the drivers for some of those changes, so you touched on workforce, maybe touched on finances as well. What do you think is the main force which is, you know, causing pharmacies that we see on our high streets to kind of change the way they look at the moment?
So I suppose the drivers for each of those issues are all separate and all distinct. So the workforce element, we've had, I think, the recognition of pharmacists and their clinical skill and expertise has gone up in recent years. And we've seen with the advent of the PCN DES, the ARS roles have come in, and I think as the scope of the community role historically has been quite narrow, the broadening of scope and change away from those services has led many colleagues to go and explore elsewhere. So we've suddenly had an extra 3,000 positions in England for pharmacists to go and inhabit. And that has taken away a significant chunk of the locum workforce. It's taken away some of the regular pharmacists, and it's led to a bit of pressure there. I think the other side of that is the pressure on the funding envelope is a government policy decision. You know, our contract is largely national. We do a little bit of local commissioning, but probably about 98% of the funding that comes through a community pharmacy is driven by the national contract. And what happened back in 2016, there was a negotiations failed and contract got imposed with a cut in it, and we've stayed flat since that point. And anyone who's vaguely aware of the climate at the moment will know that the inflationary pressures on every aspect of life and business have been really, really quite tough in recent years. And we've had to go through that on a 0% contract inflation rate, with the workload rising at about 30% greater than it was at the start of that period. So that's probably the two issues that have really driven the changes in the market. And obviously we've mostly seen the effects on the corporate pharmacies. So what I mean by that is the pharmacies of multiple ownerships with big companies backed by them. And they're much more agile to make decisions that are wide ramifications. So things like decisions about closing businesses, because they've got so many different venues, they've got the big head office behind them. Whereas if you are an independent pharmacist, that decision's a much bigger thing to do. You know, you've often got your own personal house and security against your lease. So it's much harder to take a more devastating decision in that point. So I think we've only seen that side of the market change so far. I think the other side of it is still to come, and many people are struggling to get by. But the news this morning is really, really positive, I think. And hopefully we'll be able to get some vibrant businesses out to the other side of it.
Okay, so it sounds pretty tough. And Jonathan, I guess, would it be fair to say that things are equally as challenging in GP land?
I think so, Phil. It's been a really tough few years, hasn't it? And the pandemic, which was difficult in itself, has led to a legacy of increased demand across the whole system, including general practice. We've heard from Adam in terms of what's happening in pharmacy, and we know that our hospital colleagues are absolutely affected as well. And part of that then impacts on general practice, because people who are waiting longer on the lists for hospital appointments are coming back to their general practitioner because they are struggling or still in pain or whatever condition it is that they've been referred for. They're asking us to try and bring forward their appointments, even though we don't necessarily have the ability or ways to do that. We know that patients report frequently that they struggle to get appointments with general practitioners. We also know, however, that we're offering more appointments than ever. So if you compare the number of appointments that were offered and delivered in general practice in September 2019, so that was before the pandemic, that was 1,106,000 appointments in a month in September 19, or there or thereabouts. September 23, so just over a month ago, it was 1,337,000, actually nearly 1,338,000. So about 230,000 more appointments were delivered compared to September 19. Now that is compared to the workforce, where depending upon how you look at the numbers and how you cut the numbers, at best you think that the numbers are probably flat. At worst, they're going down. And it varies from month to month with people that are leaving and people that are joining. It also depends upon how you cut the numbers. So if you include GP trainees, the numbers look a bit better. If you exclude trainees, then the numbers look a bit worse. And there's a debate about which number you should use, of course. Because not all GP trainees will go on to be fully qualified GPs or work in the NHS. So there's a scepticism sometimes whether you should include those numbers or not. The bottom line being, we are offering more appointments, there's greater demand with the same or less workforce to deliver that. There's also the complexity. I think patients find this confusing. the way I put it is this, that when I first became a GP, we're talking 20 years ago, what was the offer from the practice? It was the GP or it was the sister, wasn't it? That's who you got to see. There was no other options. Now you ring the practice and actually there's a whole array of healthcare professionals that you could be directed towards. So yes, the GP is still there. There are practice nurses, there are advanced nurse practitioners, there are paramedics, there are pharmacists. And this is different to the pharmacist that like Adam is working in a community. This is pharmacists working within the general practice itself. We've got social prescribers, all kinds of people that are working in the surgery. And I think patients find that difficult to get their heads around. It's happened quite quickly and it's happened during a pandemic. So it's doubly confusing for them. We are grateful for that extra workforce in general practice, but we are also having to supervise these healthcare professionals, quite rightly, ensure that they're working as we'd want them to do and delivering the outcomes for our patients. And we're also having to manage patients who, I would say, understandably, are still saying, hold on, no, I want to see a GP, if you don't mind, even though we might think there's somebody else that's more appropriate for them to see. So that's all difficult. There have been a number of reports that have come through in recent years. So GPs will have heard of the Fuller report. They'll have heard of the Hewitt report. They may well have heard of the House of Commons Health and Social Care Committee report. And then also the delivery plan for the recovering access to primary care. So all these things have been coming thick and fast, many of them with asks of general practice, some of them designed to improve access. But let's remember, that's on the back of increased demand and no more people to deliver at those appointments. So it's a challenge at the moment.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think you've both painted a challenging picture. So I guess the framework that we're going to go on to talk about is part of the way that we're going to look to address that for the future. So tell me a little bit about the strategic framework. What is it? Who's been involved in producing it? And then maybe we can get on and look at some of the main features of that and how that might change the way we deliver services in the future. So I don't know who wants to start there. Jonathan?
Yeah, thanks. I'll crack on with this. So you'll be aware, of course, that the health and care landscape all changed last year and clinical commissioning groups disappeared. And in their place, we have integrated care boards and integrated care systems. So as we were approaching having an integrated care board for NHS Cheshire and Merseyside, we felt that it would be helpful for us to have a primary care strategy. We decided actually fairly early on that we would have a strategic framework, which gives a little bit more flexibility, makes it a bit more high level. It covers the whole of Cheshire and Merseyside, but it allows our 9 places to develop their own plans that are relevant for their local populations. That's why it's a framework rather than a strategic plan, as it were. And we did quite a lot of engagement with this. So, somebody put pen to paper, which was largely myself, but then really wanted to touch base with the people that are working on the ground in general practice. So spent a lot of time talking to local medical committees. We had a primary care forum at the time, and we talked to the forum quite a lot around this. We went out with questionnaires and had a meeting with primary care network clinical directors. So there was a lot of engagement that took place to understand, well, what is it that you think we should be trying to do here for primary care? And what would a framework look like? We did the same with pharmacy. So I went along to local pharmaceutical committee meetings and local pharmaceutical network meetings. And that was really helpful, really helped me to understand what was going on in the world of pharmacy. Adam can obviously say much more about that than I can because of his background, but helped bring me up to speed and make sure that we were capturing that in this framework. And then what we then tried to do was to ensure, this is the first 2 chapters that we're publishing here, general practice and community pharmacy. We haven't said that. We are intending to go on and complete the whole thing with a dentistry and optometry chapters as well. We haven't done those 2 chapters yet. But if you look at the document, you'll see that we've tried to have the same broad headings for both general practice and community pharmacy. And when you see our action list, we've tried to incorporate them all into one list. There are many of the actions that apply to both general practice and community pharmacy, so it required engagement across the piece.
Thanks for that. So, I mean, there's quite a lot of GP focus there, naturally. You're a GP, Jonathan, so am I. Adam, from your perspective as a pharmacist, What do you think the framework can bring to you and your colleagues?
So I think the key thing about it, as Jonathan says, actually, is that the engagement was wide, was broad enough so that we've actually got two distinct chapters. They're set out in the same way. So I think the way you look at the document, it will read consistently between the general practice chapter and the community pharmacy chapter. I think it splits out the system issues and the place issues quite well. So the system's about supportive issues, how we can do the wider transformation and harmonisation of services where it's appropriate, to try and sort of stem out any health inequalities in commissioning that we create. I think there's some financial challenges with that, but we'll get through that. And it'll also tackles things like the infrastructure needs. So example of that is read, write access to health records, primarily GP records, read access to bloods and diagnostics. A lot of members of the public believe we can already access in pharmacy any other NHS records, when actually our real view is quite limited. We've got summary care record access, and normally that's about it. We might have the odd letter on discharge from hospital, depending which hospital that patient's been from. But the majority of the time is we're limited to SCR and the information we can glean from a prescription. And it's largely been the same the other way. So people elsewhere in the system don't have a real idea of what services an individual's accessed in a pharmacy, for example. If Jonathan issues a prescription to a patient, he has no easy way of viewing if that patient actually picked it up, taken the medicine, being compliant and concordant with the medicine, or do they rock back up a couple of months later saying nothing's got better, but then they've never actually used the intervention that he's issued to them. And I think that's the bit we need to get through. So from a system point of view, we're trying to fix those elements of it, and that's what the framework challenges the system to do. From a place, again, it's a healthy challenger to a place strategy. And I mean by place, probably both health and the wider partners in a place. So when they're putting their own strategic plans together, it gives a bit of a guiding principle that you can centre a conversation around, broken down into bite-sized actions, distinct and specific, to see if they've been considered or not. And I think we've seen through the journey of clinical commissioning groups, post-primary care trusts, the ICB from a pharmacy perspective gives us quite a lot of hope, because it's been the first time in quite a while where the key commissioners from a community pharmacy angle are the same key commissioners from a general practice angle and from a secondary care angle. So you can start to see a possibility of some agility, some linkage, some shared pathways. Whereas before, we've had sort of the NHS England local area team commissioning some parts of it, and we've had the clinical commissioning groups having responsibility to commission the other part of it. And that's been really difficult when you're trying to unpick pathways or move budget around to do things in a different way. Suddenly you come up against the silo walls. So I think the ICB element of it gives us quite a lot of hope in terms of that, how that can progress. And the strategic framework is a really good document to bring together. This is the sort of things we want to do. These are the prompts for places or system to think about and to consider how they're best to tackle that. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't dictate to them how they must do it, because it's got to be right for whatever one of those spatial frameworks you're looking at. It's got to be the right solution that works at that spatiality.
Okay. So obviously, if you want the detail, you can download the framework from the ICB website. But maybe if I could ask you each in turn, if there was one or two big ticket items from the framework that you think from your perspectives will make a big difference, either to clinical colleagues or patients, what would you think they would be? So again, Jonathan, I'll come to you first.
I think it's really difficult to then try and pick something out, because all the things that we've included, I would say, are important. As I say, if people look at the framework, you'll see we've divided it into some what we call service delivery elements and then some enabling themes. So in the service delivery, we're looking at, you know, how we are commissioning and contracting for these services. And there are some important things that we need to think about there. So think about general practice, for example, and Adam can come on and talk about pharmacy. The way that we commission and contract for general practice isn't straightforward. It's complicated. Some of it is nationally mandated. Some of it, there is local flexibility. So what is within our gift as an ICB to change with regard to that funding without destabilising all of general practice? So there are some thorny questions in there about how we might want to do that. And why we'd want to do that. And one of those things we might want to do it for is because of the second delivery element, which is about tackling population health and health inequalities. And I would want to emphasise that as being an important theme in here, because it is so important that we try to tackle the health inequalities that are out there and improve health for people that are in the sometimes the poorest neighbourhoods, the most challenged and deprived areas. And we often find that the people who most need healthcare are the ones that are getting least healthcare or find it the hardest to access healthcare. So we need to try and address that. And maybe we can do that through how we commission and contract. Access is such an important political topic at the moment. I know if you talk to your local MP and ask them about healthcare, they will tell you how many letters they're receiving all the time from their constituents saying, I can't get to see a GP, I can't get to see my dentist, I'm waiting for my hospital appointment, whatever it might be. So we know that access has to be tackled. And we're doing that largely through the primary care access recovery plan that we alluded to earlier. Quality performance, how do we ensure that the services that we're delivering are safe and of high quality? We have to be doing that. And also, what is the role of general practice? That might seem like a really odd question, but our GPs are often saying to us, you know, it feels like I am all things to all people. What is it that you want me to do as a GP? Because I'm getting to a point where I can't do all these things that I'm being asked of. And so there's something there about how we really clarify what it is that we feel we need from a general practice offer for our community. And then supporting all of that. So how do we do that in an integrated way, working in partnership with others? How are we ensuring that our workforce is resilient and our workforce is growing and our workforce is healthy? How are we working with our estates and with our data and intelligence and ensuring that the computers work when you turn them on? And how are we working with our patients along this as well? So I'm glad you said, Phil, you know, how will our patients benefit from this? And we want to work with our patients to make sure that anything that we're doing is done with them alongside us to get the best possible outcomes. And then finally, how do we do research and innovation and how do we change our models of delivery? Because we know that if we just keep doing the same thing, we'll end up with the same results. At the moment, we need that to be different. So we need to be encouraging research in primary care, which I think is really important, but also how we think about how we deliver stuff and how we can be brave to change some of those models.
That's brilliant. Thank you. So, Adam, same to you. Are there a couple of takeaways from the framework that you would highlight to listeners?
Yeah. So talking about the inequalities and the areas of deprivation, I think one of the things I often point out to people, there's a pharmacy care law. There was a study done that was published in B&J Open a number of years ago, where pharmacy bucks the inverse care law. So what they did, they looked at the percentage of the population that lives within a 20-minute walk of pharmacies. And they had a higher percentage of the population the more deprived the area was. And I think some of that's linked to our contract and how we're commissioned based on volume, based on number of prescriptions largely. So generally the pharmacies go where the need is highest. And I think that's some of the bits that come out in terms of how do we utilise that, because we've got them there as a fact. We don't particularly commission a meaningful volume of service locally. We do lots of really good stuff on our national contract, and we tend to implement that very, very well at a local basis. We don't choose to do much else. And I think that's probably where the suggestions within the framework are most strongest. The really important bits I mentioned before around the data access, as is some of the enabling factors, the data access, I think the communication to the public on how they access services or where they should go for what ails them is really, really important, as is the clarity and the consistency of offering, because I think one of the things about having quite a disparate commissioning element, so the services you can access today in Liverpool are vastly different from the services you can access in Warrington, even though it's 20 minutes down the 62, significantly different. And the communication is therefore really, really difficult because you're dealing with it on such a small footprint, trying to get a key public message out to say, if this is what's up with you, this is where you go, is really difficult. And I think that's something we can start that off. So with the seven new areas that have been announced today. So sinusitis, sore throat, earache, infected insect bites, impetigo, shingles, and uncomplicated urinary tract infections in women. They will all be treatable by the majority of pharmacies from the 31st of January onwards. And I think actually getting the comms to the public out so that they don't have to be signposted in a very formal route by another part of the system, they can go direct to the pharmacies for that. That's the start of the sort of messages we need to do. And whatever we decide to do locally above and beyond that, we need to get the comms right too. So if we harmonise the rest of our minor ailments service, which we've got an ambition to do, if we can find the funding to do so, I think it's a 0.008% of our budget we need to allocate to it, but we're really struggling to do that at the moment. If we can do that, then getting that message right to patients is crucial. Alongside that, I would say for the system beforehand, it all felt quite siloed, with us being on one side of the commissioning arm and the GPs being on another, the dentist being slightly different, and the optoms being slightly ajar again. Given that we're now all under the auspice of the ICB, we should be able to talk workforce in one conversation. We should be able to talk pathway plan development as one conversation. So all of that is where the framework starts to put some reality into that sort of situation.
That's great, thanks. So here's the thing, fellas. I think, Jonathan, you pointed out at the beginning that we're not short of reports in the NHS. So how's this going to be implemented? Is it a mandate to providers in the community sector that this report and its suggestions will need to be implemented, or is it a voluntary code? How's that going to work?
I think, so it's a framework. So this is what we want people to have a look at. The advantage of having a strategic framework for anything is it allows you to, when something new comes in, to look at it against the framework and say, okay, are we wanting to do this? Is this part of what our strategic direction would say? So if it is, that's great. We can align it. We can crack on with it. If it's not, then is it a must do, got to do anyway? Or is something that we can think about and judge according to that? I think the way it will be used, I think we've created a list of actions. So if you look at the document, you'll see for each topic, there's two pages. The first page gives a bit of a background. It might link to some national guidance or some reporting, might give some stats and data. And then page two of each topic gives a list of actions, system level actions. And by system, I mean across Cheshire and Merseyside, and place level recommended actions. We have 9 places in Cheshire and Merseyside, each of which aligns to our local authority areas. And so you'll see, I've just pulled up the action list because we've then created one big action list, so you don't have to kind of search the document for them all. And it's things like, 1.1.1 is exploring and outlining how future monetary allocations will be distributed. And we've committed to do that in the next couple of years for both general practice and community pharmacy. For improving access, we're wanting to see increased satisfaction on the GP patient survey results. And we're hoping that will be the case. We're wanting to work with the media to promote general practice and community pharmacy access routes and inform about the different models of care. And actually, that links entirely with what Adam's just been talking about. How do we make sure the public understand where they should go and for what, and what they should expect? So if you do ring your GP with knee pain, actually, what should you be expecting? And it would be reasonable to expect that the receptionists may signpost you to see the physio who works in the practice rather than perhaps the GP, and why that isn't fobbing you off with the physio, but genuinely trying to put you in front of the best person to manage your condition at that time. So we've got this action list. We've got a timeline for each of the actions. All I need to do now is to put an owner next to those actions, and we've got ourselves a work plan. So that's the kind of the next step then. And we can start then to report to the ICB as to how we're getting on with this strategic framework.
Okay. And then I suppose as a follow-on for that, if I'm a healthcare professional or a patient and I've read the framework, I like what it says, but I've got some suggestions, how do I feed into the processes? Is there a mechanism for that? Adam, can I maybe come to you on that?
Yeah,
one?
So I think from an ITV point of view, we're always keen to engage with people. We're always keen to hear about people, and there's a way you can put in questions at each of the ICB meetings and the committees that are held in public. So system primary care would probably be the most optimal place to ask a question relating to this or to proffer a suggestion. And I think that's where both Jonathan and I attend system primary care, and we'd be able to pick that up and take those on. I think the key thing in terms of the audience for this framework, while it would be really, really interesting for the public to engage with it, I think it is pointed at the places, it's pointed at the people who are already making the strategic decisions and coming up with the plans in their places. How do I enable this? How do I make the future come alive, I guess? So the people we're expecting to get most use of it are the place directors and their teams, as well as the actual ICB executive team as well. The other side of it is for places like the representative committee. So if I put my other hat on, where I'm chief exec of one of the LPCs locally, they need to be making sure that any plans or any ambitions that the sectors have feed into the framework and have a clear owner and an action that's in there. And they'll actually be using that framework to say, well, it says in that action, we should have considered this element about the pharmacy contracting route. My role will be to actually highlight places to go, I can't see where you've done that. Can you show me how you have? Or can you tell me when you're planning on considering that? So it gives that sort of broad, quite a sensible, quite a calm conversation around the issues that we need to progress as a system. And it is incredibly complex as a system. You know, you can see in the document how many actions we have. It's pages and pages of them. And we've only considered half of primary care so far. So it is going to be a longer term document to use and to develop. And it is really important that we keep it alive. So I think the onus is on us as a group and as a cohort of professionals working in the system to make sure that does come alive and make sure we do use it with regularity. In 6 months' time, we should still be picking it up and going, how does this align? Is there anything that's changed? And, you know, already pre-publication, we've had the announcement of the pharmacy changes. We're probably going to need to wash through those in the strategic framework to make sure they work, because some of the things that are in the framework at the moment have now been decommissioned. We'll do that, and that's fine, but that's the perfect part of the document to lead to almost a natural review and challenge as we go through.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. So we're nearly out of time, but how I normally like to wrap these things up, it is the Health Innovation Network, after all, is to ask you to kind of turn the clock forward 10 years. The framework's been adopted. You've both got knighthoods. Tell me how it would feel different in that future scenario, in both of your respective scenarios in primary care, if everything you're hoping to achieve in the framework is actually accomplished. So, Jonathan, I'll come to you first. Just briefly, what do you think will be different?
Well, you know, the nirvana, the future of general practice, where everybody can get an appointment, you know, whenever they want it. Are we going to achieve that? I'm not sure. Are we going to be in a better place? Hopefully, where there's a number one, a greater understanding from society as to what the offer is and how they should best access healthcare. And do that through primary care. If we just got rid of that confusion and then that angst with reception in terms of how do I allocate you to the best person, that would be a wonderful thing. So some of the communication stuff that we've got in here, I think is crucial to try and do that. I'm not naive enough to think that we're going to solve all the woes that we have in the NHS at the moment through a framework, but it should be putting us in the right direction. If we can tackle the health inequalities bit, if we can really get to grips with that, we can start to make a real difference to people's future health. I often hear people say, you know, they're very proud to work for the National Health Service, but they don't. They work for the National Sickness Service. So how do we start to change so that we are trying to tackle the causes of ill health before they occur? And that's what we need to try and do, rather than just trying to treat people when they reach that point of crisis. We're just trying to run to stand still at the moment with that, aren't we? Let's get on the front foot and try to prevent things from happening.
Thank you. And Adam, your views on the future?
Yeah, I shared a view, and the National Sickness Service is a thing I've said quite a lot recently, and I think it does get people focused on thinking about what are we doing? Are we just treating things? So I think there's two documents I read at the same time when I think of the future of pharmacy. One is the Nuffield Trust's published The Future Vision for Pharmacy, and the second in Cheshire and Mersey is a framework, and I think they align quite well. So I think if you're looking forward a decade, we'll have a whole raft of independent prescribers in pharmacy that aren't there today. So all of the cohort that come out of university in 2026 onwards will come out as prescribers already. And many of the existing workforce will be there. So I think that leads to a different world. So I think there's four probable things to focus on. One is around preventing health and supporting well-being, and actually bringing community pharmacy to role to support people and the communities to stay healthy and well, particularly around reducing health inequalities. I think there's a providing clinical care for patients. So that's a much more clinically focused role community pharmacy can have. Pharmacy First is the first of this, and I think there'll be more to come as we go through. And actually, we can lead the way a little bit. If we're really brave as a system, we can commission things ahead of them coming out nationally, or even above and beyond what comes out nationally, to say, what problems are our population having in Cheshire and Merseyside that actually, like Jonathan says around the physio comments, don't belong in general practice because actually they could be better dealt with elsewhere or more accessibly dealt with elsewhere, depending how you look at it. The other side is about living well with medicines. I think pharmacy is steeped, they are the experts in medicines by definition. So actually supporting people to access and live well with the medicines and treatment they take, including any new and advanced therapies as they emerge, to get better outcomes, to enhance safety and deliver better value for the NHS is crucial. So I think that's one of the things that's coming out. And then the last bit, as I've said previously in the podcast, the teams all felt a bit disparate in primary care. So because of the nature of the commissioning and the nature of the contract, it hasn't really felt integrated yet. Obviously, that's one of the things about an integrated care board. It's in the title. Having that integration within a neighbourhood or primary care network offering and getting all of the disciplines working together so that pathways can be designed. What's right for Winsford, for example, will be very different to what's right for Central Warrington. And I think just getting that right so that the networks themselves can talk to each other, we provide time for that to develop and to design things, I think that's crucial. So I think that's my four big asks.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and of course to you for listening. You've been listening to me, Phil Jennings, in conversation with Adam Irvin and Jonathan Griffiths from Cheshire and Merseyside ICB. We're going to put links to the Primary Care Strategic Framework and those other documents that were mentioned on our website. So please do have a look. And more importantly, tell us what you think. We'd be really interested to hear your views. So finally, I'll just give Adam and Jonathan a chance to say goodbye. So, Adam.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening. Look forward to the future.
To you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been great.
Okay. And it's goodbye from me. I hope to hear you again next time. Bye.
Thanks to our guests, Adam Irvin and Dr. Jonathan Griffiths, and to our host, Dr. Phil Jennings. If you'd like to find out more about the Primary Care Strategic Framework for Cheshire and Merseyside, there are links in the podcast notes. Thanks for listening.